welcome the star of Iraqi Court TV, Saddam Hussein.
I saw my new lawyer in my cell last night. He seemed so scared to meet me, I just smiled. He said to overturn my sentence, I must convince them I'm, he fears, still crazy after all these years. Still crazy after all these years. I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize. So many of my closest friends I shot. And that jury was a joke on my appeal. I'll make it clear, I'm too crazy to have any peers. All right, I condone torture. I spied on people. And all of my staff is in the pen. But if you take these things together, you know, these days, that's really pretty American. Huh? I have a new theory of psychiatry. I saw it on the Oprah Winfrey show. And though I know I've got some issues, I discovered the someone who's more crazy if you had to choose. Yes, I'm crazy, but not like Tom Cruise.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just tuning into this program or listening to Present Shock and Everything Happens Now by Doug Rushkoff. Doug Rushkoff argues that we are being overwhelmed by the technological advances. He looks at how our society is reacting to this media world.
Why is this a book, and why is that the medium for the message that you're giving right now about Present Shock?
Well, the hubris of writing a book is, on the one hand, claiming that I'm allowed to take a year to contemplate a single thing, right? It's saying that there may be ideas that can't be conveyed in a bullet list, right? In a sort of a digital, in a thing. I can't tweet this quite. And it's also inviting people, you know, inviting, not demanding, but inviting people to kind of surrender their autonomy over 7 or 8 hours of their lives, you know, or in a sense to take it back, but to surrender it to me as an author, to say, you're going to be with me for 7 or 8 hours so that I can actually engage with you on a level that I can't in a CNN column, that I can't in a tweet, that I can't in an article, you know, that I can't in a single talk. And ideally, it's a way of saying that we're allowed to do this. We're allowed to dedicate 7 hours to something. You know, we don't have to shove it into that one plane ride, and if we didn't get done with it by the end of the plane ride, leave it in the seat back there. It's like, wait a minute, who says that, right? Who says we're not allowed to do that? I mean, I realize that a book is anachronistic in a digital age, and I'm not, and partly by doing that, what I'm saying is that just because we embrace digital time and move into this doesn't mean that all these other times don't coexist with that, right? Yes, we're moving into a culture where sort of video game logic and making choices in real time is the predominant form of communication and entertainment and immersion. But it doesn't mean that all the others just go away, right? They can still be there. We can still go to the opera. We can still play softball, right? Even if everyone is doing extreme sports and reading tweets, right? There's still a place for these kinds of experiences. You know, I come from that world. I'm a book person. That's where certain kinds of ideas are home, right? That's where I'm at home. So that's there. But I'm doing it with the full knowledge that the way maybe I should, but the way I sell a book these days is not by saying, you need this, your business is going to fail if you don't get this. If you don't understand digital time, then you're not going to be able to market to people. If you don't understand presentism, then your tweets aren't going to make sense. You know, It's like, what is that? Buy this or else, right? Read this or you're in trouble. You know, that's the sort of self-help book maxim, right? You need this help, right? No, it's not you don't need this, right? But this is cool. You're allowed this. You're allowed this. You're a human being living in the 21st century. You're allowed to have time. You know, you're allowed to have some time. And ironically, the more time you take, the more time you have. It works the opposite way. The more you try to catch up, the less time you have. The faster you answer your emails, the more emails come in. The slower you answer your emails, the more you'll see people somehow solve those problems without you. You know, and they really do. You know, so I guess it's that, you know, that books are such a wonderful discipline, both as an author and as a reader, to say, no, I'm reading this book. I'm reading this book. And if I can create more excuses for people to say, no, I'm reading a book, then I've done my job.
Great. Well, thank you, Dad.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions?
Or thoughts? Please wait for the microphone to get to you. She'll be in charge of finding the people, I guess.
Hi.
Hey.
Thank you so much. My question was, I was wondering if any aspect of your assessment can be connected to the unemployment rate. Do you see any sort of even correlations or associated factors?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, and this sounds awful, but since when is unemployment a bad thing? Seriously, everybody's out there. We got to create jobs. We got to create jobs. Do you all want jobs? Do you want jobs? No, you want stuff, right? You don't want jobs. You want the stuff that you get for having a job. Jobs are an artifact of the industrial age. People didn't used to have jobs. People worked and made stuff and sold it, right? It wasn't until chartered corporations came and put everybody out of business by law that we had to go work for a company. And instead of being paid to make a thing, you were paid for the time that you put in for the corporation. You were selling your time. It's what the Bible calls slavery. That's indentured servitude. Right? The only reason we don't need jobs because we have enough stuff. Right? There's more than enough houses. They're burning down houses and destroying them in California to keep the prices high, right? Because so many are in foreclosure. We can't let people just live there. We got to tear them down. We're destroying food every month. We burn food to keep the market price on food high. You know, so what if they're starving, but they didn't work? The only reason we need people to have jobs is so that we can justify divvying out the stuff we have to them, not because we need them to make more stuff. Instead, now we create new excuses for people to have jobs to make more stuff that we end up sticking in storage units. Right? There's more, too much stuff. We have more stuff than we need. We create new excuses for people to buy stuff. And Black Friday, can we get them to consume more? How are housing starts? More houses? Are we tearing down more woods and building more houses? If not, it's not healthy. Why? Because of the industrial age requirement of the economy to grow. Right? So I think that... I don't know in our lifetimes, but I do think we'll get to the place where we realize, oh, we actually can have robots tilling the soil and doing all the stuff in the fields, and we can just eat it. And that's not a bad thing. And when we work for meaning. When we work to make things better. When we work, we're healing the sick and teaching children and feeding ourselves, not just trying to, you know, import more plastic crap from China in order to keep this, you know, economic machine going. You know, it's a program that's outlived its welcome.
Do you think that the reason that digital platforms kind of lack a narrative that you were saying earlier is based on the fact that there's a lack of context awareness, maybe? Meaning if it knew more about where we were at any given time and how we were feeling, which it seems to be going that way, that would kind of remedy the problem?
Well, it might remedy the problem or it might create a new one. Right, the illusion of narrative in digital technology is generally what they call predictive modeling. Right, so they use big data analysis to figure out, oh, Johnny's 12, but we can tell from his statistical profile that he's going to be gay by the time he's 14. Right, Mary is 36, and we can tell from the way she's tweeting and whatever that she's probably going to be dealing with infertility issues. Right? So they can then send you the ads and things that can help you manifest the person that you're most likely to be. Right? That's not storytelling. That's life creation, right? That's turning people into programs rather than letting people be the unpredictable, quirky, weird things that they are. I mean, I do think there's a context that you can get in digital spaces, but that context is much more like Beavis and Butthead or The Simpsons or South Park or Mystery Science Theater. It's more of a kind of a meta sensibility that you see frames within frames within frames. You kind of see media more in a fractal sense than you do in a linear sense. So the way we make sense of things is by recognizing, like when you watch The Simpsons, what's the hit on The Simpsons? Is it that Homer saved the nuclear power plant from disaster? No, it's that you recognize this is a satire of that other form of media. And when you recognize the satire, when you make the connection, you feel more oriented. Right, so what we're moving towards is a much more moment-to-moment sense of orientation and grounding that we do get from screens within screens, from relationships of things to other things, or this to that, from getting the joke, really more than getting to the end. Orientation.
Well,
it was good. He had the mic upside down. It was perfect. The perfect moment.
How do you think present shock is affecting the way wars are fought today?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in the one sense, we're learning to think of wars less as things we win and more as chronic situations that we get involved in. Right? You don't win wars, it turns out. I mean, you never really won a war. I mean, you just won the battle and killed people. But there is this sense of war now as an ongoing state. I mean, one really interesting phenomenon is, and I talk a lot about it in the book, is drone fighting. Right? Drone fighting is a digiphrenic approach to war, right? Because here you are, if you're the soldier, now you are in a room outside Las Vegas, right? Flying a plane that's in Afghanistan, killing people far away. Then you take off your thing, you get in your car, you go home, and you have dinner with your wife and kids. It turns out that drone pilots who are doing virtual combat experience higher levels of post-traumatic stress disorder than the ones who are in the actual battlefield. And I would argue that's because of this digiphrenia, because of this new way of fighting war in a present shock universe where you are trying to manifest two selves at once that are ultimately incompatible. Right? And I think that's really what's going to start to happen now. And in some ways, that's a positive sign, right? Because we're saying, oh, my gosh, no, there's this other self. There's this part of me, just like us as a nation. There's this part of us doing this thing that's not consonant with our values, with who we are, with what we believe in. And we have to reconcile those two things. But the more we alienated we are from it, the more it really does seem distant. That's when it does get pretty weird.
I don't need it.
You're in charge. You need it for the mass media audience.
I think it's kind of misleading that you're saying we live in a digital world. We don't. You have to have an analog front end to any piece of digital equipment. It's just machine method of dealing with all sorts of things, media and whatever. Why don't you just say machine world?
I think there's a difference between living in a machine world and living in a more digital world. And I don't think we live in a digital world. I think we live in a real world. We live in a physical universe, but we live in one that's now dominated by a kind of a digital bias as opposed to a mechanical bias. The difference, I mean, and there's a few, the difference is mechanical age technology does the thing it does. A shovel digs, a car drives, a steam shovel does this.
Analog processing is much more powerful than digital processing. It's just we don't know how to store the stuff in general.
Well, digital, I think the difference in digital, the kinds of things I look at as digital age technologies, and you can argue they're all just the same, they all just create more choice. When I look at digital age technologies like computers, robotics, genomics, nanotechnology, I look at things that you set in motion and then have something like a life of their own. They try to survive. They replicate. They change things. They keep going without you, where a shovel kind of just sits there. So I think there's a different bias. I mean, you can argue it's all part of the same continuum. You're just getting fire.
It's just neutral information in terms of certain numeric systems. That's all it is. And you could have another numeric system.
You can. You can. But you can't. But as but the kind of culture that builds around the invention of text ends up, for whatever reason, being different than the kind of culture that builds up around the printing press, which for whatever reason is different than the kind of culture that builds up around computers and digital technology. Now, it could be the reasons why could be completely stupid, right? And based on nothing but our perception of how those devices work in different periods. But they do have different what we call media environments. Right, they have different media environments. That's what Marshall McLuhan is really into, is the media environment. He said there's a light bulb, right? The light bulb creates an environment of light. We don't care about the content. There's no content in a light bulb until you put like a gobo in front of it and make it have words or something, or put an exochrome slide or a Kodachrome slide in front of it. But the light bulb itself creates an environment, right? Air conditioning is a technology, creates an environment. Fire creates an environment. Television creates an environment. Telegraph creates an environment, and digital technology creates an environment too, right? And without being too techno-determinist about it, it's not that digital technology makes this thing happen, but as our culture changes, we adopt digital tools, our values change, we change the tools that we develop, and then those tools that we develop do change the way we see things. Yeah, in the back.
But how much of the like you're saying the differences between like the culture around print, the culture on the internet, how many of these things are actually inherent to an environment of like a digital culture, and how much is it just that it's a new media, and so for the past 10, 20 years it's been unregulated and it's been a wild, wild west, and we even see it become less like that?
It's interesting. I mean, I've always felt like we're in danger of folding the digital media environment into the industrial age. Right, that's been the main thing that I've been kind of kicking and screaming about since 1998. I did this talk, Why Futurists Suck. Right, and the thing I had gotten mad about was that the thing was here. It was here. You know, I was kind of a Mondo 2000 reality hackers, boing boing kind of person. I thought, here we got the technology. You know, digital. Digital means the digits. We're here. We can be makers. We can actually start making the world. And then I saw everyone talking about, oh, don't, this thing is coming. Wired magazine said, the tsunami is coming. It's going to change your business. It's going to do this. Invest in that. The long boom is happening so that industrial capitalism can keep growing and growing forever and ever. You know, and then
you can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Us people are just poems. We're 90% metaphor, with a leanness of meaning approaching hyperdistillation. And once upon a time, we were moonshine, rushing down the throat of a giraffe. Yes, rushing down the long hall despite what the PA announcement says. Yes, rushing down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that it will always be there. It's part of a pair. There on the bow of Noah's Ark, the most prestigious couple just kicking back, parked against a perfectly blue sky on a morning beatific in its Indian summer breeze. On the day that America fell to its knees, after strutting around for a century without saying thank you or please. And the shock was subsonic, and the smoke was deafening between the setup and the punchline, because we were all on time for work that day. We all boarded that plane for to fly. And then while the fires were raging, we all climbed up on the windowsill, and then we all held hands and jumped into the sky. And every burrow looked up when it heard the first blast, and then every dumb action movie was summarily surpassed, and the exodus uptown by foot and motor car looked more like war than anything I've seen so far. So far. Fierce and ingenious, a poetic specter so far gone that every jackass newscaster was struck dumb and stumbling over, oh my God, and this is unbelievable, and on and on. And I'll tell you what, while we're at it, you can keep the Pentagon, you can keep the propaganda, you can keep each and every TV that's been trying to convince me to participate in some prep school punk's plan to perpetuate retribution. Perpetuate retribution. wrath, even as the blue toxic smoke of our lesson in retribution is still hanging in the air, and there's ash on our shoes. And there's ash in our hair. And there's a fine silt on every mantle from Hell's Kitchen to Brooklyn, and the streets are full of stories, sudden twists and near misses, and soon every open bar is crammed to the rafters with tales of narrowly averted disasters, and the whiskey is flowing like never before, as all over the country, folks just shake their heads and pour. So here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation under the stone-cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down a threat the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape into their heads to find peace in a form of a dream. Peace in a form of a dream. Peace in the form of a dream. Cause take away our PlayStations and we are a third world nation under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office and that phony election. I mean, it don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeb said he'd deliver Florida, folks, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me, cause I am a poem heeding hyperdistillation, and I've got no room for a lie so verbose. Yeah. Yes, I'm looking out over my whole human family, and I'm raising my glass in a toast. Here's to our last drink of fossil fuels. May we vow to get off of this sauce. Shoo away the swarms of commuter planes. Find that train ticket we lost. Cause once upon a time, the line followed the river and peeked into all the backyards. And the laundry was waving and the graffiti was teasing us from brick walls and bridges. We were rolling over ridges, through valleys, under stars. I dream of touring like Duke Ellington in my own railroad car. Yeah. Of waiting on the tall, blonde wooden benches in a grand station aglow with grace, and then standing out on the platform and feeling the air on my face. Give back the night its distant whistle. Give the darkness back its soul. Give the big oil companies the finger, finally, and relearn how to rock and roll. Yes, the lessons are all around us, and the truth is waiting there. It's time to pick through the rubble, clean the streets, and clear the air. Get our government to pull its big dick out of the sand of someone else's desert. Put it back in its pants. Quit the hypocritical chants of freedom forever. Cause when one lone phone rang in 2001 at 10 after 9 on 911, which was the number we all call when that lone phone rang right off the wall, right off our desk and down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that the whole world turned just to watch it fall. Mm-hmm. while we're at it, remember the first time around? The bomb, the rider truck, the parking garage, the princess that didn't even feel the pee. Remember joking around in our apartment on Avenue D? Can you imagine how many paper coffee cups would have to change their design following a fantastical reversal of the New York skyline? It was a joke at the time. And that was just a few years ago, so let the record show that the FBI was all over that case, that the plot was obvious and in everybody's face. And scoping that scene religiously, the CIA, or is it KGB, committing countless crimes against humanity with this kind of eventuality as its excuse for abuse after expensive abuse, and they didn't have a clue. Look, another window to see through. Way up here on 104th floor. Look, another key, another door. 10% literal, 90% metaphor. 3,000 some poems disguised as people on an almost too perfect day. Must be more than pawns in some asshole's passion play. So now it's your job, and it's my job, to make it that way, to make sure they didn't die in vain. Shh, baby, listen. Hear the train.
And now for something completely different.